Hi, I'm John Waters, and you're listening to The Projection Booth. Keep on listening, or I'll have you killed.
Tonight is what it means to be young, and I'm Mike White, and welcome to another episode of The Projection Booth, and with me as always is...
I can dream about you, if I can hold you tonight.
Robert Townsend.
Meteor Man, baby.
Mondo Justin.
Evening, ladies and germs.
Can I ask you something?
Anything you want, brother, except, like I said, day one, baby, you don't ask me about my time in Turkish prison. You don't know what you have to do to survive, Michael. One day, you'll get through your damn thick skull and...
Dude, are you high right now?
High? Yeah, man, on Streets of Fire, baby.
Yeah, well, that explains it. Well, go ahead, I'm timing you. Go.
Streets of Fire, 1984, Walter Hill, Michael Pare, William Dafoe in a black leather bib overalls, a badass pick fight, Diane Lane... W. Vilkberg, Bubba Gump, 50s doo-wop singers, high awesome atmosphere, newbie fireman who can't talk to Jill Hannah and Steve Martin's Roxanne, Jim Steinman, Lee Ving, Honey, I Shrunk the
Time.
Damn!
Let me just clean that up for you, because you're clearly Streets of Fire punch drunk this week.
That's okay. I've got this one, really.
Take a breath.
Okay. 1984's Streets of Fire is an atmospheric tale that takes place perhaps in an alternate universe. As is mentioned from the get-go, it's a rock and roll fable. The film features, at the time of the film's initial release, newcomer Michael Pare as Tom Cody, a John Wayne-type figure that's called back home by his sister, who just so happens to be played by the one and only Deborah Van Valkenburg. He's brought in to rescue his ex-girlfriend, who is now a huge rock star. She's played by the young but more experienced actress than the rest, Diane Lane. And she's just been kidnapped right off the stage of her big homecoming rock concert that the whole neighborhood witnesses. By a collective of wild, greasy, pleather-wearing bikers led by Wilhelm, or Willem Dafoe. Did I miss anything?
Dude, Rick Moranis, you forgot to mention him. You tried to mention him earlier, but I cut you off. Rick Moranis stars in the film as Diane Lane's sleazeball promoter, Billy Fish. And you've got some fun appearances by even more up-and-coming actors at the time who went on to do bigger things, such as Bill Paxton, Robert Townsend, Amy Madigan, and Bubba Gump himself, Michael T. Williamson.
Incidentals, my dear Watson. And Amy Madigan, she went on to do bigger things.
Dude, Field of Dreams, hello. And she's married to Ed Harris.
If you gag, Mike, will he stop talking now?
Sorry. No.
Can I ask you something? Did you eat paint chips as a kid, by chance?
No, but your mom did. Oh!
Dude! All right, let's roll this Fargan clip.
Dude, we're covering Streets of Fire here, not Johnny Dangerously.
Writer-director Walter Hill picked an ensemble cast of young, relatively unknown talent for this rock fable. 19-year-old Diane Lane is rock singer Ellen Aim. With 13 films behind her, she is the most experienced of the actors.
When I went in for this audition, this was like the first one where I came in trying my best to come off like a rock person would, just being semi-blasé, and I guess he saw a quality that he wanted in Ellen Aim.
The story is set in motion when Ellen Aim is kidnapped by the Bombers, a 200-member gang. Her nerdy manager boyfriend, played by Rick Moranis of SCTV fame, hires Soldier of Fortune Tom Cody to save her. For Cody, Hill selected newcomer Michael Paré.
Paré, when I met him, is not a terribly experienced actor, but he has this wonderful kind of combination of toughness and innocence that I thought was really perfect for the character, and I thought he had the ability to project that.
I liked the script. It was, you know, an exciting adventure movie, something John Wayne would take or, you know, Gary Cooper would take. So, shoot, I mean, anybody who'd pass that up has got to be in the wrong business.
It is doubtful that John Wayne or Gary Cooper would have a sidekick like Amy Madigan. Her role of McCoy was originally written as a Hispanic male named Mendez until she convinced director Hill to change that part to a woman.
I said, look, I like the part of Mendez, and I want to play that part, and I think it would be a real good idea to have a woman play the sidekick, you know.
Part of being a director is grabbing a good idea when you hear it.
Knock, knock.
And she turned out to be terrific in the film.
Besides his sensitivity to actors, Hill is known for his unique visual style. Termed exaggerated realism, it incorporates rain-splattered streets, low light, and smoke to create the world of the fantastic.
This, I think, was a little tougher than most of the others that I've done in terms of its look, because everything all the way to the edges had to be exact. If the real world impinges upon the fantasy, the illusion of fantasy vanishes, so that you had to have absolute control over the visuals.
Filmed mainly on the back lot of Universal Studios' famed New York Street, it took many months of massive reconstruction to create the sets for Streets of Fire. It became the world's largest enclosed set with the addition of this canvas tarp. Covering six blocks, it allowed the many night scenes, so essential to this picture, to be filmed during the day, thus avoiding costly night shooting. The most complicated scenes were the opening and closing concert numbers, shot on location in a Los Angeles theater.
I hadn't really shot any musical production numbers before, and I don't think that I really probably knew how to do that as well. We really didn't have a lot of rehearsal time, so that we were very much blocking as we were shooting.
With original songs written by the likes of Tom Petty and Stevie Nicks, the music was an essential ingredient in the film's story.
It's crucial to the conception of the movie because the characters, the situation, the entire framework of the piece really has to do with rock and roll.
While that was a bit longer of a clip, it was pretty rare at this point, right?
Yippers, you know, that was the audio from a long-gone featurette I ripped off of my early 90s Japanese Laserdisc that I own of Streets of Fire.
That guy's voice sounded really familiar.
That is because it is the one and only Doug Llewellyn, the announcer from the People's Court.
Do-do-do. Do-do-do-do. Welcome to the People's Court.
Michael, these antics must cease if we are to keep our time constraint.
Yes, indeed. So let's simply get down to brass tacks here. This was your pick this week, so I know you're a huge fan of Streets of Fire. But what about my opinion, Justin? What about me?
I'll give you 16 minutes. Go!
16 minutes. All right. Well, at the time, no. Streets of Fire is, it's a really out there kind of movie. Yeah, I am a Walter Hill, I don't know if I say fan, but aficionado. No, not even that. I am a Walter Hill admirer, and I the jury's still out for me on Streets of Fire. I've seen this thing probably, I'd say at least six or seven times, and I enjoy it. But something deep down inside of me tells me that I shouldn't. I don't know what it is.
Why?
I don't know. It's just, it's such a weird movie. You know, I think the thing, it really boils down to Rick Moranis for me in this whole movie, because Rick Moranis is just so completely unpleasant the entire time, and there's no redeeming qualities to him whatsoever. And he has just a ton of screen time in this. You know, I forgot until I watched it again recently just how much he's on screen and just what a jerk he is the entire time. Like, I was hoping at some point he would do something redeeming, but no, it's like everything he says, he has to be a jerk. He's just, you know,
well, it's true, but he does make an attempt at the end when he says, you know, in the last minute of the film, he says, listen, I'm not going to stand in the way of you and Alan. You know, and then Tom Cody's like, listen, Fish, her lifestyle's not for me. I'm a loner, a rebel.
There are things you shouldn't know, things you couldn't know.
And that's, remember, he looks, seems like, you know those tags on the back of mattresses? Well, I cut one of them off, Billy Fish. I'm bad.
But yeah, it's a very interesting movie, and it is a rock and roll fable, as you say. It's got a very unique look to it. All shot in a soundstage, completely, you know, everything was under Hill's control in this movie, as far as I know. I mean, it's a very locked down film where he created everything. You know, it's funny. It reminds me a little bit of One from the Heart, in that Coppola did kind of the same thing, where he just kind of built this world on a soundstage, neon lit, and but I'd say Hill went a little bit farther with it by kind of that mixing of time periods and everything. You know, the cops drive these old cars. You know, things look old, but things look new at the same time. People are dressed somewhat modern, but then there are old cars and old. You know, some of the music feels a little bit more older, even though it's very contemporary. And then, yeah, Jim Steinman, you know, he's got those bombastic, you know, operatic kind of songs and stuff. You know, it's, you know, being a Jim Steinman fan, I definitely enjoyed it for that. Though it's weird because the one song that I recognize from the movie more than anything is the song at the end. The help me out here.
I Can Dream About You.
Yes. Yeah. It's the I Could Dream About You stuff is the one song that I recognize more than anything else.
Absolutely. You know, it was, you know, the whole film is sort of, you know, sort of a music video in a sense, you know, and I do think you hit the nail on the head comparing it to One from the Heart for sure. What you don't know also is you could compare it to Road Warrior because George Miller actually filmed the whole thing under a set.
Really?
That he did all these backdrops. Yeah, backdrops. Wow. Australian Outback. I mean, it's all on set.
That's crazy.
But you didn't know that, did you?
No, I did not. I thought that was filmed in the Australian Outback. That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I do. You know, some of these shows, I do manage to come up with a fact or two. So, yeah, you know, I really, you know, it's really interesting because I can certainly see, you know, I totally understand what you're saying about how it's like you like the movie, but you don't want to like it, or something tells you you shouldn't like it. And certainly from a story basis, you know, it is a little light. But I can't help but feel the same way. And I have a very nostalgic connection to this film. Like it was, you know, growing up was one of my mom's favorite movies. And I think it's because she had a crush on Michael Paré because she was a huge Eddie the Cruisers fan as well. So I was really exposed to this movie from a very early age. And, you know, I can remember my mom has the soundtrack of this movie on vinyl, you know, when I was growing up. So she was always playing it. And so it's like I've always just had this weird connection to this movie. And I do enjoy it. I do love that it's this rock and roll fable. And what I love about it the most is the atmosphere of the film and how it is this world that exists somewhere that no one can really, you know, peg. And I think it's best said to call the film existing in the future past. You know, I think that's the best way to look at it. It's really interesting because I've talked to some other people and other people, you know, I get their opinion on the film and other people think that it is, you know, some post-apocalyptic place, you know, that exists in. I don't ever think about it as existing in some futuristic time where, you know, the world's been killed off. I just fear it's this really cool netherworld, you know, and I think that's what I like about it so much. It's just, you know, that whole atmosphere of the thing is I love to death.
Well, personally, I really just enjoy Willem Dafoe wearing those amazing bib overalls. I mean, I don't know if they're pleather. You had mentioned pleather earlier. They almost look like latex, you know, and it's just like, I don't know. It's very like fetishistic the way that he dresses and stuff and just and his awesome, you know, the hairdo that he's got rocking and stuff, which is kind of it reminds me a little bit of The Loveless, that other movie that he did. But and the guy is more pale than I've ever seen him before. And so it just really contrasts with those black bib overalls that he wears. And it doesn't look like he would be into Diane Lane at all, if you know what I'm saying. It's just kind of a strange thing, but, and it's nice to see Lee Ving in his gang there. And Li Ving is great at the end when they're having their little pickaxe fight, and he just keeps shouting. And it's just like, I keep waiting for him to like break into, you know, let's go to war.
He's like a pantomime, you know, he's like, the whole time he's got his mouth like, he's like screaming but silently the whole time. You can never like, wait, do I hear Li Ving? No, I don't hear him. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Dafoe costume. You know, I've tried to get my wife to make me a replica, but she won't. You know, even I was gonna go so far as just getting a pair of overalls and spray painting them black.
But well, they look like waiters more than anything. You know, I keep expecting that he's like, you know, I just came out from you know, catching some trout here. Well, now it's time to go to the rock show, and I want to see this new hot young singer, my kidnapper.
Right. It you know, it's funny you mentioned the bibs, because I know there's a huge fan of those bibs, and I think he owns a pair of them, actually, is this guy named Richard Edwards. Nice. Huge fan of the bibs. He loves the film. It's his second favorite film after Patch Adams.
Wow.
All right, so, you know, on that note, we're getting a little windy here, so let's cut to an interview Mike and I did many moons back with the star of Streets of Fire, Mr. Michael Paré. So, you know, starting right off, getting right back into it, you know, you come off of Eddie and the Cruisers and you get Streets of Fire. How did you get involved with the project?
They made me an offer.
Okay. What did you like so much about the script? Like, did you just read it and then you just fell in love with it?
Well, you know, it was a big action movie they were going to shoot in Hollywood. You know, Eddie and the Cruisers was relatively, you know, $5 million, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that wasn't a big budget. And the movie I shot in Australia, I don't know what the budget on that was, but it was a period thing. And, you know, this was a big studio movie. You know, and Walter Hill and Diane Lane. And I thought, fuck, yeah, I'm in.
Nice. So, you know, reading the script for the first time, how did you envision the Tom Cody character?
Pretty much as it was written, you know, didn't get to talk a lot. You know, it was, you know, they said it was like a Clint Eastwood John Wayne role. So, I that's what I had in mind when I was, you know, thinking about it. You know, there wasn't a lot of background. You know, it was a Western. It didn't have to be, they weren't really, well, you know, I'm getting lost. You know, you're asking a very specific question. How did I approach the character? Like I approach all characters.
When you look at that character, do you develop any sort of backstory to him than what's, you know, on the screen?
You know, I don't like to work like that, because if everybody's making up their own story, you know, you don't know what everybody's playing. So I pretty much play what's on the page. You know, it's my hometown. Diane and I were, you know, like high school lovers, or that age, you know, before you were 21. And she went on the road with her band, and I joined the military, you know, or the militia or whatever, you know, you'd want to call it in that situation. You know, when the bombers attacked, you know, our little village there, my sister asked me to come home. And the backstory is, it's a guy who comes back to his hometown to clean things up, kind of almost like Walking Tall.
Now, can you recall, you know, reading the script for the first time, and was there a lot in the script that eventually you guys never shot, or that was just kind of cut out at the back end of production?
The big thing was that the end fight with Willem, I pull a knife out of my boot and kill him. That was in the first draft, and they took that out. I think it was Walter's idea. He really liked the idea of winning at any cost, but that wasn't like, you know, the PG was still like an important rating to get, you know, a mass distribution. You know, and they didn't think they should have such an anti-hero that, you know, it's like, fuck this, fair fight, I'm not going to lose.
You know, I've seen some footage with Walter where he's talking about, you know, one of the reasons why he liked you so much was that, you know, you had this certain quality of innocence to you. So, you know, I know you and I talked about this before, but, you know, was James Dean an influence on your acting, on your career, interest in going to acting?
Well, you know, it was Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Paul Newman, Robert Mitchum, all of those guys, I felt we were all kind of like kindred spirits. You know, but I got in trouble because I remember reading one of James Dean's biographies, and they said, why did you go into acting? And he says, the money. And I thought it was funny, so I was saying that in interviews for a long time. You know, why did you become an actor? The money. I thought they all knew that that's what it came from, the James Dean biography. But you know, people said, oh, what a fucking, you know, trite, shallow guy.
Walter Hill is, you know, sort of notoriously known for, you know, for not being an actor's director. So I was wondering, you know, what your experience was working with Hill on that level.
Well, you know, I think, you see, I think Walter comes from writing. Writers aren't always that good at communicating in person. You know, if they have to write something out, you know, and they have time to consider everything they're saying, I think they're better, you know, communicating like that. You know, and Walter is, you know, he's a tough son of a bitch himself. You know, he's like a cowboy. You know, his director's chair is made of leather, and it says Lone Wolf on it. You know, and he used to go to a lot of gun clubs, and you know, he's not a delicate guy. You know, and I remember we were doing ADR, and it was my first love scene was with Diane Lane. And when they said we had an ADR, the love scene, I kind of freaked out. And I said, I need help with this. I need help with this. And, you know, Joel Silver, the producer, I know, got on the phone to Walter and somehow persuaded him to come over and direct me through the ADR. But I know Walter isn't that kind of guy, you know. And, you know, it was an enormous picture for me. It was, you know, an enormous budget for the day. And I was really new, you know, it was overwhelming. And I think that bothered Walter that I was, he saw me as this needy guy, or I'm not sure. You know, I always wondered why Walter never wanted to work with me again. And I think, you know, he's just too much of a gentleman to say, you know, this fucking kid, we hired him and, you know, he was so needy and he wanted direction and he wanted help. But he was used to working with guys like McNulty and David Carradine and, you know, guys who were older and more experienced. I was overwhelmed. I was incredibly intimidated. And, you know, I was looking for help, and Walter wasn't that kind of guy.
So do you experience any kind of stress there, being that you're carrying the movie on your shoulders?
A tremendous amount of stress.
There's been a lot written in terms of, you know, how Streets of Fire was supposed to be the first in a trilogy. I was just curious to see if you, you know, if, was that ever on the table in terms of, you know, you might be doing other films once you signed down to do Streets of Fire?
Yeah, they told me it was a trilogy, but then everybody at Universal moved to 20th Century, and that was no longer an option. You know, it was made by Universal, right? And then Larry Gordon and Joel, the rest of the guys involved, went to 20th Century, so they lost ownership of it, and the guys who stayed at Universal didn't want anything to do with it because it wasn't their movie.
I mean, was there any kind of scripts or concepts in the works for those movies
well,
that were to
they
follow?
Said, Joel said that the next draft, the next sequel was going to be in the snow, and then there was going to be the desert.
You guys shot the film, or bulk of the film. You did some stuff in Chicago, and then you went and shot on the Universal backlot. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, the intensity of that set and how it was tarped. Was it difficult to do stuff, you know, hearing the wind in the tarp and stuff like that?
Well, the birds took up residence, so, you know, the gun wrangler, you know, had to shoot off a shotgun a couple of times before Walter said action, so the birds would shut up. And when it rained, they couldn't shoot because they had to pull back the tarp because they were afraid it would collapse. You know, it was weird shooting under the tarp. It was night all the time, and then you get off of work. You know, we shoot during the day under the tarp, so we shoot day for night. And then when we got off of work, it was night, so we were living in the night, in the dark. You know, it was kind of disconcerting, I guess.
Working on the film, you know, it's got this very unique atmospheric, you know, situation going with the film is very atmospheric. And it's got great style. And I was, you know, just kind of wondering if you could share some insight into what you thought, you know, this film takes place and where.
Well, you know, like I said, nobody was asking me, you know, what I thought. You know, nobody was really interested in my questions or answering my questions. But Andy Laszlo, the cinematographer, you know, he would light for like 8 hours. We used the, you know, lower whacker. But the rest was kind of like, it could have been an alternate reality on another planet, you know, or something like that, you know, an alternate universe. The prop guy was constantly saying, we're shooting this movie like it's a Western, so there can't be any paper or styrofoam around. You know, it was super stylized. The wardrobe girl, Marilyn Vance, you know that wardrobe that I wore, it was all Giorgio Armani. It was like, you know, $20,000 suit of clothes. it was just amazing stuff. I was overwhelmed, and you know, as the character of Tom Cody, I wasn't really distracted by any of that stuff. I was just pretty much, you know, dealing with the fact that, you know, I was even in this alternate reality, Tom didn't belong there, you know, because, you know, I could have went on the road with Diane and been like, you know, in Coal Miner's Daughter, and look how that turned out for him, right? I mean, they ended up together, but it was a tragedy in itself. It was a weird thing. I met with Larry Gordon and Chuck Gordon recently, and I met with Walter a couple times, and none of them want to make another one. You know, they say, well, you know, and people that I talk to in my world, you know, would love to have it. I mean, it's playing in Japan now all year long as one of the best movies ever made. You know, you would expect somebody, some banker or some Wall Street guy to come along and say, come on, we can shoot this movie for $40 million, and make a mountain of money on it. Why not, you know, and bring in some new music? But nobody wants to do it. I don't get it.
Because this was one of your earlier films, you kind of cut your teeth on some stuff too as well, right? Didn't you learn how to, like, ride a motorcycle on the film as well?
Yeah. You know, you see, this is, you know, because I know I'm not imagining this, but, you know, we had these scenes in Chicago with me riding a motorcycle, and nobody asked me if I knew how to ride a motorcycle. And I didn't. But, you know, the prop guy was kind of a friendly guy. He was my age, and he was, I think he might have been from New York. Craig Raish, I think was his name. He said, well, Mike, I can show you how to ride a motorcycle. And it was raining. And him and one of the Teamsters, you know, took me to an alley, you know, in Chicago at night, the night before we shot this stuff. And, you know, I was racing up and down the alley on a motorcycle, and I had never been on one before. You know, I had never driven a standard shift before. You know, and, you know, I didn't have anybody, you know, like coming, you know, by and saying, listen, Michael, you know, I wanted to take boxing lessons. I said, no, you don't want to do that. You know, because of the fight scene, I wanted to, you know, move a certain way. And they said, no, it's going to be like John Wayne and just throwing big roundhouse punches. So, yeah, you know, I guess that's why, you know, Walter didn't want to hear that from his actor. He didn't want to hear me saying, you know, I would like to do this, I would like to do that. You know, maybe that's why they don't want to make another one. But they wouldn't have to do that anymore. I've done all that now. You know, I've done quite a few. I've done half a dozen motorcycle movies, and you know, I've taken boxing. I can hit the speed bag and a heavy bag, and you know, and I can drive a stick. You know, I mean, I did a lot of first time. My first love scene with Diane Lane. Come on,
can't get any better than that, right?
Yeah, but imagine, you know, I'm still really new in the business, and here I am climbing into bed with, like, you know, one of the arguably most beautiful women in Hollywood.
You and I have talked before, so, you know, you kind of talked briefly a little bit. I was just wondering if you could talk some more about, you know, working with Rick Moranis and you know, the character he played versus the character you played, and the tension between you two in the film.
Yeah, you see, there's a thing that in movies you're not supposed to do it for real because you could hurt somebody, right? Like, you can't really hit somebody, you can't really stab somebody, you can't really shoot somebody. But, you know, like, a comedian can go at you, like, full bore because there's no physical damage. So Rick, you know, is a comedian, you know, and he just drove me nuts. It was like a antagonistic relationship, and some people said that was the best relationship in the movie. Because, you know, when I looked at him, I had some very serious, you know, resentment and anger towards him. But, you know, in reality, I think I should have, you know, punched him in the face right off the bat before we got in the car and said, okay, you can come along, but boom. You know, I don't want to hear your fucking mouth except yes and open your wallet. You know, I think it would have been funny if Rick had to play the whole movie with a Band-Aid across his nose. You know, but, you know, the guy was enormously talented, and he's a great human being. I mean, I play some of the Second City TV stuff. I have it on my iPad, and it's just hilarious stuff. But, you know, I was so scared. I was so out of my league, I thought. You know, I didn't need anybody, you know, tormenting me like that.
I wonder if you could talk a little about the famous, you know, the pickaxe scene at the end. Didn't it take you guys quite a long time to film that?
Yeah, we shot 2 weeks, me and Willem, and then they shot 2 more weeks with the stunt guys. You know, that was one of Walter's you know, calling card. After hard times, he was one of the best fight movie makers in the business. He still is, I think. I mean, he's down there working. You see, he's down there making a movie with Stallone in New Orleans and Thomas Jane. So it's Walter Hill. Why didn't Walter bring me in? You know, it's a period thing. It's a, you know, I could have been in that, but Walter doesn't. You know, you don't know what goes on in that in the minds of those guys from that era. You know, Spielberg, Walter Hill, Scorsese. All those guys are from the same era, and sometimes they just say, "Nope, that's it. I don't want to work with them anymore."
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's kind of like I'm sure you're familiar with the whole, the Stanley Kubrick and Malcolm McDowell scenario,
yeah.
You know?
Kubrick would never work with Malcolm either.
Yeah, isn't it? It's really interesting. The Lincoln Lawyer just came out not too long ago, so I was curious to see, you know, what else you have working on, what you're working on right now.
Well, I just did that, well, I didn't just, like a month ago, I shot another movie for Lakeshore called Gone that Hayter Dahlia directed and a man named Seyfried is the star of. And I did an episode of Memphis Beat. I'm shooting an episode of House next week. You know, Lakeshore really likes my work, so they have another one for me in March, but I don't want to give out any information until we shoot it.
Okay. And then don't you have a website that people can go to check out what you're working on?
I have a fan club, but, you know, I don't and they keep track of everything I'm doing.
Okay. And then my last question for you is a Streets of Fire question, kind of a silly one. We talked about it last time, is I have to ask you if you ever were tempted to ask Willem Dafoe if you could wear those black latex bibs.
Yeah, they were kind of weird, weren't they?
Okay, welcome back. Paray, man of few words.
Indeed, but a super nice guy. I want to comment real fast. A couple weeks back, I had said about my computer crashing, and I'd lost a lot of the interviews. And Michael Paray was actually one of those as well, and he was actually real kind enough to allow me a second chance, and I was able to revisit the time we had originally spent with him. So I'd really like to say thank you very much, Michael Paray, for being such a wonderful guy.
And I appreciate him answering all of these same questions that I asked about the Philadelphia Experiment all over again. So even though we're not going to do a show on the Philadelphia Experiment, but I'm a big fan of the movie, so I just like to ask him questions about it. I think that's one of my new hobbies.
All right. Yeah, we should maybe do a Philadelphia Experiment show sometime down the road.
But not use any of the questions that we asked him.
Nope. And then we should also maybe do a twofer of the Philadelphia Experiment and the Philadelphia Experiment 2.
Oh, a vastly underrated film.
If you say so.
I don't, actually.
All right. So, you know, earlier you had said that you're in a Walter Hill aficionado. So I think we should talk a little bit about Hill, because I'm actually a huge Walter Hill fan. I really appreciate him for what he does. You know, he's really great. I think he's a great director. He's a great writer. You know, look at all the stuff he's written. It's just so phenomenal. You know, in recent years, some of his stuff hasn't been as good. You know, I know you're a huge fan of his Yojimbo Last Man Standing.
yeah, big fan. Go ahead.
I said, do you own that on Blu-ray?
Yeah, I don't even own a Blu-ray player, but I own that one on Blu-ray just in case I ever happen across a Blu-ray player.
That's right. I hear you. Yeah, and so, but you know, of course, you know, Hill started out, wrote Hard Times with Charles Bronson. He wrote Hickey and Boggs. He wrote one of the Aliens films. I think he wrote my favorite Aliens film of the four, Aliens 3. And then he 48 Hours, The Warriors, Southern Comfort, The Long Riders. Pretty amazing career, actually. I'm a pretty big fan of Walter Hill's. There's not, but only a couple of films of his that I really don't care for. And Last Man Standing is not one of those.
Oh, of course. Can't be a Walter Hill fan without loving Last Man Standing.
I actually, when Last Man Standing came out, I actually threw away my Criterion Yojimbo because I said, what's the point of keeping it? Because it's right here, Last Man Standing. So there's no point.
Exactly.
I was out the door.
Yeah, never watch any of the Fistful of Dollars at all. Just out the door, you know, threw away your Dashiell Hammett. And you're like, no, this is the perfect adaptation.
Totally. There's no reason. By the way, when did this show stop being about Streets of Fire and start being about Last Man Standing? I'm just curious.
You are the one who brought it up, sir. So
all right, I'm done. So yeah, I mean, you know, you say you're aficionado, but I mean, surely you've got to feel I mean, I know you're a fan of the Warriors. Obviously, we went to frickin' New York and talked about the Warriors. But, I mean, you don't like Southern Comfort? You don't like the Long Riders? I mean, come on now.
No, I like those movies. I mean, I do like Southern Comfort quite a bit. And, you know, we talked about this before. I'm a big fan of, like, Trespass and some of Hill's more minor films. I'm thinking about doing a show possibly on The Driver with Ryan O'Neal one of these days because I think that's, you know, a little bit of an underrated film. And, yeah, I like Walter Hill a lot. Sometimes, you know, one of my friends has compared him to like the poor man's Sam Peckinpah. And I can kind of see that at times, but then other times he, you know, kind of smacks of genius a little bit. I guess I have some problems with Hill just because of some of the stuff that I dug up when I was doing research for an article I wrote on Alien 3. And just, he doesn't necessarily come across as being, one of the most artistically inclined people when I was doing that research. You know, it was basically, here's a story idea. You need to hold to this idea, and just kind of gave these parameters to all these different writers, and they were bad parameters to start out with. So, and the other problem too was when they were writing Alien 3, they didn't know if Sigourney Weaver was coming back, if Michael Biehn was coming back, who was coming, you know, Lance Henriksen, they didn't know if any of these people were coming back. So the story parameters were basically like, so make it so that Ripley can be in it or not. It's not necessarily a really great atmosphere for a writer.
Right, and you should really mention, because I've, you know, I know I read your article, I'm a huge fan of your article, and you know, you told me a long time ago about something that never really made the article, which was the fact that you know, to stay true to what we've done in the past, and that's that originally they tried to replace Sigourney Weaver with her cousin Sigourney Beaver. Her third cousin from Schenectady.
Who I went to Schenectady to interview recently, and let's roll that clip.
All right, so, you know, I do want to talk some more about the performances in the film by the actors, because, you know, I'm a big fan of Michael Paré. I know you and I are both huge fans of Deborah Van Valkenburg, and, you know, I'll admit, I'm a huge fan of Rick Moranis. Like, you know, one of our favorite writers, Ed Naha, and the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids novelization. So we should probably talk about Rick Moranis as well.
Yeah, I'm a big, well, I won't say I'm a big Rick Moranis fan, but I liked him in Parenthood. I'm a huge fan of Strange Brew. You know, I used to just absolutely love watching him on SCTV, and I loved his Jerry Todd character and all those things. But I don't know, just something about, you know, I know that he's supposed to be a jerk in this movie, but he's just overly so. And, you know, it's just, I don't know what it is about it. It's just, I'm all for having unlikable characters in films. And sometimes I really enjoy those unlikable characters, but just something about Rick Moranis in this movie, man, he just really makes me mad whenever I see him.
Well, it's either, you know, the interesting thing about the character and Rick Moranis playing him is either it's the best casting in the world or the worst casting in the world. Because it doesn't fit. It doesn't look the part. But on the same token, you could kind of look at that as being a stroke of genius. Because then, you're just like, well, it really adds this different level, you know, to the authenticity of the whole concept in a certain level.
And if he's getting Diane Lane, man, hats off to you, brother.
Hope for everyone.
Yeah.
There's someone out there for everyone.
Yeah, she is looking way fine in this movie. I mean, she was what, like, she was still in high school at the time of this movie, you know, like still getting like tutored and stuff. You know, she's a few years away from, you know, I know she started before Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous States, but she was like, you know, big time teenager in Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous States.
Sure. And she was like 5 years old in this movie.
She was only 5 years old? That's crazy.
You, sir, are a pedophile. No, yeah, I know. I agree with you. And the funny thing, like I said earlier, she's the most experienced of the bunch, you know, because look at Michael Paré. He had only done a couple movies before. Rick Moranis hadn't really done a lot of movies, even though he had been on SCTV. Deborah Van Valkenburg, 2 or 3 movies. You know, Robert Townsend hadn't done Hollywood Shuffle by this point. Michael T. Williamson, nothing. William Dafoe. You know, William Dafoe, it's really fascinating that, you know, he'd done a couple movies, I think, by that time, but, you know, you would think that by that time he'd maybe been more of a juggernaut, but the best was yet to come for him anyways. So, I mean, there's just overall, there's some really great performances there. I really think it's cast beautifully, you know, with the exception of the debatable aspects of Rick Moranis' character for sure. You know, and going back to the themes of the film real fast, essentially, I don't care what you say. Ultimately, it is a Western. It's a Western that takes place in this weird, you know, place that no one can really peg down where it's at. You know, there's that comic book mentality to it as well, which is fluent in Hill's other work, you know, certainly The Warriors as well. So, I mean, I don't know. Like, I don't really understand how, if you want to debate in the fact that the film is light on story, sure, you can say that, and I could probably agree with that. But I can actually forgive that aspect just because there's so much other things going on that I really appreciate, like the music, the atmosphere, the cinematography, the acting. Just those are stuff that I really look for in good movies. So
yeah, I won't say that it's light on story. I mean, it is very much a Western feel to it. I mean, there's trouble in town. Van Valkenburg, you know, wires to her brother to say, come on back and, you know, rescue this, you know, rescue us from these hooligans. And it's kind of a little, you know, Seven Samurai-esque in that kind of way, too, where it's like, you know, we've got this trouble. We need this hero to come in, and he is very much billed as a hero. I'm surprised that they didn't use, like, you know, the another Jim Steinman song, the "We're Holding Out for a Hero" kind of thing, you know, sure, to have him introduced into this. And he comes in, what, he's been in the war, he's got like this long history, he's got history with these people in the town and everything. And I don't know, I won't fault it for story at all, because it does what it needs to do. It's got, you know, like, you know, one trajectory is to rescue Diane Lane, and the other trajectory is to get Willem Dafoe out of town, you know. And so you got the two basic things to any story, you know, get the girl, get rid of the bad guy.
Right. We should also mention, since we're going in that route, is the fact is that you and I talked to Deborah Van Valkenburg a while back, and she had some interesting things to say about Streets of Fire. She had mentioned, you know, that the script was actually much different than the shooting script. There was a bunch of stuff that never made the final film that Hill was just cutting down. He was just chopping at, you know, right away. So much substance just to get through the film, because I guess there was something going on where it was running too long or it was a little clunky and there's too many characters. So he just kind of thinned it out a little bit. And then also, she was originally going to do the voiceover narration for the film as well. They never made the film. They never made the final cut either.
Right. Well, this feels like one of those films that sometimes these can end up being really great. Sometimes they end up being not so great, where it's like, you know, that the director has had this in his mind for a long time and really wants to put this whole huge vision on screen. You know, it's stuff like, you know, Cimino and Coppola and all these other guys, you know, where they make these, like, you know, here's this one big film. This is my Vietnam, those kind of things, you know. And I can see Hill having this whole, you know, long story going on in his head. And, you know, this was supposed to be the first chapter of a trilogy, and they never got to the other ones because, unfortunately, this one tanked at the box office. But, you know, I'm sure that those other films would have explored more of these kind of ideas. And wasn't it like, you know, this was the first element of three? Like, there was supposed to be, like, this was the fire, and then there was going to be, like, an ice one where it all took place in the snow or something, and then, like, you know,
The desert was the last one.
Or, oh, I thought it was, like, Waterworld. They're going to have, you know, the polar ice caps melt, and Michael Perret's there on his little schooner and stuff. And
and Bruce Willis shows up, and it's, right, it's a Western town.
Right.
It's in and it's Yojimbo.
Yeah.
No, but then, you know, yeah, exactly. And it opened up, when it came out in theaters, it opened up against Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom, and it also opened up against Star Trek III, Search for Spock. So it really, yeah, didn't have much of a chance when it came out.
No, not really. I mean, a musical set in a weird, nobody knows what time this is, against two juggernauts at the box office. Yeah, you're not really. I mean, had this come a few years earlier, maybe, because, you know, like you're talking about the second chapter of Indiana Jones, the third chapter of Star Trek versus the first chapter of what could have been a new trilogy. But yeah, I think between the musical aspect of it and the newness of it, and just kind of it's, you know, it's a little off kilter, you know, not saying that in a bad way, but I don't see people flocking to see this movie. I definitely see it having a core audience and having, you know, folks discover it years and years later. Hopefully more folks will be discovering it now. But, you know, yeah, this is it's a tough break.
It seems like it could have been marketed towards younger people versus, you know, people that maybe are in their 20s or mid-20s. It almost seems like it would have been a good movie at the box office for teenagers just because it's very music video-y, you know, and they really beat the heck out of it on MTV because the Dan Harmon song, Can Dream About You, I can remember, you know, clear as day as a younger kid, just seeing that in constant rotation on MTV nonstop. And it was a video where they literally just took the last 3 minutes of the film, slapped it on, and called it a music video, you know, and had the doo-wop singers, you know, in the band or in the film, you know, on stage. So, you know, I can see really appealing to that younger audience versus someone that maybe is a little older, you know. And, you know, on that note as well, I'm a huge, huge fan of the soundtrack, this movie. Like, I love it to death. And it's really an all-star soundtrack. You know, even the music is dated somewhat now, but it's got these really good songs on it. You know, like you mentioned, you know, Jim Steinman's on it, and, you know, his flair for, you know, dramatics and music is unprecedented. And that's, you know, what really makes it stand out for me. Plus, it's got songs written by Stevie Nicks on the soundtrack, and plus Marie McKee. I'm a huge fan of, you know, she was in the band Lone Justice in the 80s, and she does the song Never Be You, which is near the end of the film. It's really great. And then plus on top of it, you got the Blasters in the movie, which that's probably the only, you know, time the Blasters has ever been in a film, you know, and it's great stuff.
Yeah, you know, what it reminds me of too a little bit is Purple Rain. You know, it's Purple Rain was a very, very simple story. Again, ends with the Battle of the Bands, one of my favorite kind of things, you know. But yeah, what reminds me, I guess, the most is, you know, they play the end song and then there's another whole song after it. And, you know, I like that they do that in this movie. And I can see where it would capture that same audience as a Purple Rain. But yeah, it was just, I don't know what I do remember them playing that video, just beating it to death on MTV. But maybe they should have had more or something, or more, you know, some sort of other kind of like release schedule of here's this first song, and then a month later we're going to release this other song, and just to show the diversity. Because that was one thing that Purple Rain really had going for it, was that, you know, When Doves Cry is completely different than, you know, than the song Purple Rain itself versus, you know, some of the other songs that were released. And then you've got the, you know, completely, even though it's basically written by the same person, but you've got the Morris Day stuff coming out at the same time, you know, showing that it's got a really different style to it. And all these songs, you know, the I Can Dream About You is completely different than the other songs that are on the soundtrack.
Sure. And, you know, on that note, Purple Rain for me always feels like it's built around the music, and Streets of Fire is a movie that has music in it.
True.
Purple Rain is almost like a musical. I mean, even though, you know, I mean, Prince is not stopping in the middle and bursting into song and dance, but more or less, you know.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, and he's talking to Apollonia when he's singing, you know, Nikki, you know, just that whole comeback, Nikki comeback stuff as she's leaving the club and everything. So, yeah, it's very, you know, it is a musical. And this one, yeah, you're right. It is more like, you know, the music is subsequent to the story, but it's definitely a part of it too, you know. And just like going to the club and going to see these concerts is such a big deal for them, you know. And it's held in a different esteem than other people would hold music.
The music is a huge part of Streets of Fire. And, you know, going real fast, I want to mention that Robert Townsend, you know, cause I'm a huge Robert Townsend, I'm a huge Hollywood Shuffle fan, and I think he's a great director. And he did a film a couple years down the road called The Five Heartbeats, and, you know, which is a great film about some African-American 60s singers, like a vocal group, which is, I kind of feel, while I can't prove it, feels like some sort of spinoff or comes maybe some kind of inspirational piece in reference to his performance and his character in Streets of Fire on a level.
Yeah, well, they even wear kind of similar outfits and everything too, don't they? I mean, when I saw this, I was like, oh, these are where the Five Heartbeats came from.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad I'm not the only one that thinks that then.
No, definitely not. And I haven't seen the Five Heartbeats. I've only, for some reason, they were doing a big promotional push with that, and they were giving away God, and this is going to date me, they were giving away singles of the title song all over the place. So I had the single of the title. And so I've only seen the little artwork of the guys on the, you know, like the, what, 5x3 art of this stuff. So
listen, singles never got the respect that they deserved. Let me just tell you.
So, Justin, we should probably mention, you know, we were talking about the idea of this being a trilogy earlier, that there is a second part of the movie being made completely without being an official sequel to it, I guess, because I don't believe Walter Hill or the other screenwriter, Larry Gross, had anything to do with this. But Albert Pune of Brain Smasher, a Love Story fame and Captain America fame, he has a sequel that he's been working on for a while. Unfortunately, it's been plagued by some production problems. Some of the camera equipment that he was using isn't really working out right and blah, blah, blah. So we talked to Mr. Pune about that a few months ago, and it sounds like stuff is hopefully going to get back on track with that. You know, I don't know how that's going to turn out. There was one screening that they had down in Austin forever ago, and one of those yahoos from Ain't It Cool News went over to the screening and, you know, completely bashed it, called it cinematic fan fiction and all this, which, you know, is kind of unfortunate that that's the only review that when I, you know, look around online, that's the first thing that comes up is one of those Ain't It Cool News jerks talking about it. But anyway, sorry, I'm not a big fan of those guys and their practices. But anyway, so I'm not sure how that's going to turn out. It sounds like it's all being shot against a green screen, kind of doing the Sin City thing. And unfortunately, the poster for it looks like it's completely taking from Sin City. I mean, you can put the two against each other and they look almost identical. So, and it sounds like it's going to be very, very dark, almost like Tom Cody's kind of gone off the deep end a little bit. So hopefully things turn out okay with that one.
Yeah, it's a mix of Constantine and Sin City.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if it's going to have the music. I don't know if Jim Steinman's coming back for that one, but something tells me no.
Just keep saying to yourself, it's only a movie. It's only a movie. It's only a movie that will have you living in the sixth dimension. Moving in the wrong direction. A new fantasy musical. Forbidden Zone.
That was the audio for the trailer for next week's pick, mine, and it's a little something that's out of this world, Richard Elfman's Forbidden Zone.
Yeah. You know, you'll never guess what. I've been meaning to tell you, I forgot. Hervé Villechaize, the one and only, you know, King Fausto, actually heard that we were covering Forbidden Zone next week, and he called me the other night, but I missed it, and I was really sad about it, but he left me a message on my answering machine. Yes, I still have an answering machine. And basically saying he wasn't interested in participating, but he wanted to wish us well. And so I just wanted to play you that really quick.
Really? Okay, let's hear it. I mean, considering he's freaking dead and all.
As I approach the prime of my life, I find I have the time of my life. Learning to enjoy at my leisure all the simple pleasures, and so I happily concede this is all I ask, this is all I need. Beautiful girls, walk a little slower.
Oh, hand me a Kleenex, please.
Poor Hervé. R.I.P., buddy. Final thoughts on Streets of Fire, Mike?
Well, yeah, let me gain my composure here. Streets of Fire, it's definitely a unique film. I hate to abuse that term, but there are things that are similar, but nothing is like Streets of Fire. It's something that you definitely don't see every day.
Agreed.
The ugly bruise of fear is swollen and festering.
A claw-fingered, scaly-skinned, half-human crustacean.
The black hole of despair. The clenched fist of doubt.
A frenzied bedlam of blood-curdling horror.
What if things were really getting better?
Hold on, folks. We're expressed to the top floor.
The Vertical Pandemonium Audio Theater. Only on mentalradio.net.
So we've come to the end of another rockin' and rollin' alternate universe episode of The Projection Booth. We both hope you enjoyed the show this week.
Certainly. While the show is available through various outlets on the web, Jackalope, iTunes, etc., we'd like to take note that you can also listen to our show through Stitcher if you have one of those fancy schmancy phones as well.
Right. Thanks to all our Jackalope listeners. We appreciate being part of your community. Also, you know, if you're grabbing up the show on iTunes, you know, please do us a favor. You know, leave us some feedback and some ratings on iTunes. It really helps. You know, also, I want to say that, you know, you should really visit the show's official website at projection-booth.com for all the updated news on us. You know, Mike's cookie recipes, rare video clips, outtakes from films we're covering, our show archives, Mike and Justin and a cup. You know, you can stop over at Jackalope and check out our new Projection Booth forum that's up as well.
Totally. I'm there daily. I'm, you know, posting nude photos of Justin when he falls asleep, and I get the Polaroid out, and I get something else out.
Okay, dude, listen, thanks for that. But, you know, check out the forum, and we'll leave you with some Dan Hartman.
We could all use a little Dan Hartman today.